So I'm here at the Psychology Department of Edinburgh University, and this is home to the Kursler Parapsychology Unit, or KPU. And I'm joined by Dr. Caroline Watt, who's part of that unit. Can you tell us something about the history of the KPU? How did it end up here at Edinburgh?
Well, it has quite an interesting history. So the author, Arthur Kursler, and his wife Cynthia committed suicide in 1983, I think it was. And they left their estate, they put it in the will, to all of the money to found a chair of parapsychology at a British university. And to cut a long story short, Edinburgh took on that bequest, so they basically said, yes, we're going to host this chair. And Bob Morris, who was an American parapsychologist, came as the first professor in 1985. And I started working with Bob as a researcher in 1986.
I came up here to my PhD, and you did your PhD here as well. Can you tell us about the sorts of things the KPU have been involved in? What's the remit of the KPU?
Well, it's very broad. I mean, we look at both what's called the psi hypothesis, so that's the claim that people can have some sort of genuine psychic abilities. And also we look at what's called pseudo-psi, so what Bob Morris used to call it, what's not psychic but looks like it. So, for instance, your PhD, looking at the psychology of deception. The reason why we need to know that is that we need to know how people can be wrong about their psychic experiences in order to rule these hypotheses out. See if there's anything left. Is there any genuine psi left when you remove the normal psychology?
And if you had to look at just one strand of that in terms of the KPU's work, or indeed parapsychology in general, and say that's the most intriguing one, that's the most interesting one, whatever, where would you go?
Well, I think in terms of the systematic research, probably the Ganzfeld studies at Edinburgh, the ones that we've done the largest number of, and also they've more consistently had positive results.
Do you want to explain what the Ganzfeld setup is?
Yes, the Ganzfeld is a method for testing for extrasensory perception, or ESP. It's a mild sensory isolation procedure that is applied to one of two people. So in the Ganzfeld, there's two people, the sender and the receiver. The receiver is in the Ganzfeld stimulation, and the sender is in another room along the corridor. The sender looks at a randomly chosen video clip, which is the target, and they try to mentally communicate it to the receiver. The receiver in the Ganzfeld is lying back in a comfy chair. They have eye shields on. They have headphones on, playing white noise, which is a sound like radio static, a red light shining on their face. And they're basically lying back, relaxing, and talking out loud about the thoughts and impressions that come into their mind. And the experiment is testing whether or not the receiver's impressions are more similar to the target that was viewed by the sender than to some decoy targets that were never viewed by the sender.
And so you're doing that, you're in the room, you've got the red light. I've never done it, actually. You've done it as
I
a
have
receiver.
Done it. Yes. It's a very nice experience. It's, you get a little bit sleepy, a little bit kind of mildly altered state of consciousness. And it's a little bit like lying on a sunny beach because you have your eyes open, but you can't see anything apart from a kind of red mist, red fog. And that's where you can sometimes see images coming in front of your eyes.
And when you did it, what images came before your eyes?
I'm actually not very good at imaging. So
very little, almost
no,
nothing.
I reported mental impressions rather than visual imaging.
Right, okay. So you get those impressions and then someone along the room looks at a target. And then how do you decide whether that's a hit or a miss?
Well, you then have to do a judging period where either the receiver or an independent judge looks at the mentation, which is the report that was made during the sending period, and the four target possibilities. And you basically judge which of the four target possibilities are more similar to the mentation. So you rank them, order from first to last, and by chance alone, you'd only get the first hit, if you like, correctly identifying the target that was actually seen one time in four, 25%. And what you do is, over a number of trials with a number of participants, combine the results to see if your combined chance hit, your combined hit rate is greater than chance, significantly greater than chance. And typically, at Edinburgh, we were obtaining results more in the sort of 33% success rate, so 1 in 3 rather than 1 in 4. It doesn't sound like much, but it is actually statistically significant.
And there's a big debate about what that means and whether it's evidence for psychic ability and so on.
Yes, it all depends on how well controlled the studies are. And the Gansfeld database obviously goes way beyond Edinburgh. And so there are hundreds of studies. And it has been a source of great controversy because many of the experiments have shown positive results, but a large number also haven't shown positive results. And so there's a lot of disagreement over how to interpret those positive results that are published.
Okay. Now, the other thing, which I think perhaps even predates your time in the field, I'm looking across your office and there's a glass jar with a spoon in it. Bring over that glass. It's very noisy. What is it? It's a Pyrex chemistry jar thing.
Yes, it's sealed.
It's sealed with a rubber bung at the top, but with then wax or something in it. And there's a very, very straight teaspoon in there. So now that's been at the KPU as long as I can remember. I don't know if it predates your time here.
I think it dates from the years when John Beloff was here. He was actually doing parapsychology at Edinburgh. He was a lecturer in our department before Bob Morris arrived. And he was interested in testing psychic claimants, and I think the idea was that this was a secure method of testing the idea that someone could bend a spoon or bend metal through thought alone, because one couldn't tamper with that spoon because it was sealed in the jar.
And the fact it's still straight suggests that it wasn't the most successful series of experiments.
It may have started off bent.
That's true. That's true, over the years, yes.
So, I actually may be holding in my office evidence.
Yes. Should we have a go at bending this now?
Nah.
Really? I'm going to have a go. Right, ready? 3, 2, 1. Bend!
That's remarkable. It's not doing anything.
It's absolutely incredible. It's nothing happening at all. Okay, so that's the KPU. What about your own research? Because I know that's looked at belief in such matters.
That's right. I mean, my training's in psychology, and I guess I'm most interested in why people have paranormal beliefs and experiences, because when you do surveys, you find that about 50% of the population have had some kind of belief in the paranormal. And of these, maybe about half of them actually have had what they think is a paranormal experience. And as a psychologist, to me, that's fascinating. What lies behind these? Are they really all genuine psychic experiences? Or is there a fair amount of normal psychology going on? So one of the things I've looked at is the role of childhood experiences on people's paranormal belief. And there's a model in the literature that says that some people, not everybody, but some people believe in the paranormal because they've had a lack of control as a child, that experienced a traumatic or somehow chaotic childhood. And believing in psychic abilities helped to give them an illusory but a comforting sense of control over their otherwise chaotic environment. And so I've done some research into that and found evidence supporting that idea. So it suggests that for some people, believing in the paranormal actually provides some kind of psychological function.
Back with the spoon. Do you want to try and make it bend?
No.
Okay, so we've spoken about the KPU and we've spoken about some of your research into belief. Precognitive dreams, lots of people have them. And I know you're right in the middle of a project, or at least starting a project at the minute on them. What sorts of mechanisms, psychological, parapsychological, have been proposed to account for them?
Well, obviously, because they feel like paranormal experiences, quite a few researchers have tried to test the idea that these are genuinely precognitive dreams telling us something about the future that we couldn't possibly know any other way. Some of the lab studies, particularly the early ones, actually came up with fairly positive results when they tried to test that idea in a more controlled way. But these results haven't replicated in subsequent attempts, so it's a bit patchy, basically. The early studies were positive and more recent ones are more patchy. We're going to follow up on that.
Well, that, of course, is a pattern within parapsychological research, that initially you get some results and then they don't replicate. We've seen that throughout the years.
Yeah. I mean, some parapsychologists would say that's something to do with the nature of psi, that it somehow is elusive. But of course, it's also consistent with a sceptical interpretation that perhaps the research conditions were rather loose to begin with, and as the researchers improved their methods, the effect gradually disappeared. So again, there's some debate over how to interpret that decline effect. But in terms of going back to precognitive dream experiences, so the lab research is a bit patchy. There's some studies have tried to do premonition registries where they get members of the public who believe they're having precognitive dreams to send in these dreams and record them in advance. We could then perhaps warn people if we have a dream that's specific enough. The big problem is that they're generally not specific enough, so premonition registries have been tried and have failed in the past. So it's very difficult to actually investigate these out in the real world. We do try and do it in the lab. And in the lab, it doesn't always come up with positive results. There's a lot of psychology, though, also in these experiences. So I think probably one of the most important factors is the role of memory. Because we all dream every night. In fact, we all have several dreams every night. We only remember a tiny proportion of the dreams that we have. And often events that happen to us subsequently can prime or remind us of a dream that we had, and then we then think, oh yes, that was a precognitive dream. But we don't remember all the dreams that aren't confirmed later, so there's a large number of non-confirmed events, if you like, a lot of non-confirmed dreams happening that we just don't notice. So there's a bit of a sort of selection bias, and I think that's probably one of the most important factors, that people only and notice those dreams that appear to come true and don't notice and don't count the much larger number of dreams that they're having that don't come true. So one of the studies that we're going to do is going to look into that factor.
So you're looking at both the normal side of it and the parapsychological
side of it,
and just starting that project now?
Yes, we're underway. We're recruiting volunteers. So anybody who's listening to this who is interested in dreams, you don't have to believe that you're having precognitive dreams, but if you're sufficiently interested that you might be keeping a dream diary, for example, we'd love to involve you in our research.
And if people are interested in getting involved in the research, they can find your details on the Curse of the Parapsychology Unit website, presumably.
That's right, and you can Google parapsychology and you'll get to the KPU very quickly. And yes, then all our contact details are there.
And finally, there are sort of super sceptics out there that say the whole of parapsychology is complete nonsense, complete waste of time, and it shouldn't be part of a university setting. What's your reply to that? It must come up many times.
Well, I think you just have to look at the surveys. You know, there's such a large proportion, although these are supposed to be rare paranormal events, actually the number of people who believe in the paranormal is huge, and the number who've had paranormal experiences is also huge. It's about 20% of the population. So to me, as a psychologist, there's a kind of responsibility for academia to look at this, to try to understand what's behind these experiences. And it may be that there's no genuine psi, but we need to look at these experiences and try to test that hypothesis to find out what's behind them. So I guess it's a bit of a no-brainer, really.
And just to finish off, can I have one final attempt at trying to bend the spoon?
Yes.
Here we go. Bend. Nothing.
Nothing. No.
Oh well. Caroline Watt at the Curse of the Parapsychology Unit at Edinburgh University, thank you very much.
Thank you.